You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
Now, Bible books typically have a theme or a focus, and I would say the focus in Ezekiel is on the glory of God. Now, I know glory is a churchy term, very churchy term. And so what is it? Let me use a word that maybe isn't a word to describe it. The awesomeness of God. That's what I would say God's glory is. It is His awesomeness in every aspect of His nature. He is intrinsically, in every conceivable way, awesome. You know, a while back I took one of my daughters just south of the Oregon border in California, where the tallest of the redwoods are. And this is one of the, you know, I'd never seen one before. And this is one of these things in nature that does provoke a sense of awe because of its mass and the size of just the height of these things. And so when we talk about God being glorious, we're talking about how He's awesome in every facet you can imagine of who He is. He's awesome in His wisdom, in His love, in His commitment to justice, in every sense. And another way to think about it is, in any possible way that we can experience God, He's awesome. And so this notion that God is glorious, that God is radiant in His power, just unimaginably glorious, woven all the way through the book. And one way it's kind of spun out is Ezekiel will demonstrate as we go through this book that God's glory, His awesomeness, can be seen in His mercy and in His judgment. It's interesting. I know that when we hear the word judgment, we all hate it. The idea that God would hold people accountable. We hate it until somebody wrongs us. Right, then it starts to make a little more sense. This notion that part of what makes God glorious is when vulnerable people are being mistreated, He can't look the other way. Right? That upholding what's right and putting down what's wrong, His willingness and ability to do that, to move in judgment, is part of what makes God so awesome. The other aspect of His awesomeness is His mercy. Yeah, the fact that He extends undeserved love to people like us, to people like the nation of Israel, the fact that He would move out of deep concern, even though He's been betrayed time and again, and extend mercy, that's a huge aspect of this as well. And we're going to see as the book unfolds how God's people, the Jews, scattered all over the world, at the end of history, are going to be regathered in the land. An act of mercy. That once they get back in the land, in a final global war, right before the end of history, all the many nations in the world will come up against Israel, and God will be their defender. Another act of mercy. And then we'll see how When the Messiah, when Jesus, when the Lord comes back to set up his glorious kingdom, He won't rip people off. He's not going to prey on people like so many human leaders do. But in His mercy, He will rule as a good shepherd. So mercy and judgment, God's awesomeness, His radiant power, that's really what this book focuses on. Now, as we open up the very beginning of the book in chapter 1, what we're going to hear about is God's calling Ezekiel and just the way that God gets Ezekiel's attention. And basically, it's pretty simple. When God calls Ezekiel, He asks him to do something incredibly difficult. It's a very difficult call. And this isn't just a thing we see with Ezekiel. We see it God calling Abraham to come out of Ur. We see God calling Moses to go serve His people. We see again and again God singles someone out, someone like Ezekiel, and calls them to do a difficult thing. And one thing we're going to see is this isn't just an event that happens to special, you know, high-level people in God's story. It happens to each of us. I realize, especially if you see God as kind of a disengaged CEO who's too busy with big issues to deal with little people like us, the idea that he would reach down and break into your world and call on you, little you, to do something, it may seem preposterous or hard to believe, but actually, the God of the Bible has a lot of bandwidth. He's able to do more than one thing at a time. And he is intimately aware of every little detail of your life. And as you sit here right now, he's calling you. Let's think about even before we come to know Jesus, when Jesus was about to be crucified, just before he told his disciples, "When I'm lifted up from the earth, I will draw all men to myself." Jesus, the Lord, is able, because he loves us, to draw us to him. The guy, John, that wrote this just in a couple chapters, tells us that Jesus, through his Spirit, through the Holy Spirit, is convicting the world, all of us, of sin, the gravity of the things that we do wrong, of the reality of judgment, of sin and God's righteousness and judgment. And that he uses that to give us, and maybe you can think about this in the night watches, you're just kind of thinking about your life, and you have that sense, I do feel like I'm culpable, that I'm going to answer to somebody, that there's a being out there that has an opinion about the way I'm living. And that sense too, that you know, my only hope is to just reach out to him for mercy and forgiveness. I think a lot of us, if we're honest, even before we walked into a place like this, we could articulate, you know, I was experiencing that. Everyone, according to Romans 1 and 2, experiences this draw, Jesus drawing us to himself. And even then, after you become a Christian, you can read how God continues in a very just day-to-day practical way, calling on us. Here, 1 Thessalonians 5:23, Paul says, "May God himself, the God of peace, sanctify you through and through. May your spirit, soul, and body be kept blameless at the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ. And the one who calls you is faithful, and he will do it." And this call he's describing here is God's commitment to call Christians over the course of your life until you're with him, to be more and more like him. And this is super practical. You might be in a fight with your spouse, feeling like you want to be vengeful, feeling like you just kind of want to strike back. And then the Spirit of God is in you, calling on you to extend love to your spouse, the same kind of love that you've received from God. So we have this sense, it's, I wouldn't call it a tractor beam, but a strong impulse from the Spirit inside us, calling us to become more like Christ. We also have all these times, 19 times in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, where Jesus tells his followers, people like you and me, to follow him. His call to become fishers of men, to be out there trying to share the message of God's love with people. His call to join him in living an other-centered lifestyle where we give ourselves in the service of other people. So all the time, every day, through his Spirit, as you sit here right now, God is calling you. And so what we're going to try to do is just ask the question, what can we learn from the way God called Ezekiel so that we can better understand how God calls us? So, jumping in, it's 593 BC. That's what's happening. 590, that's a long time ago. over 2,500 years ago. That's when God called Ezekiel. And it was at a very difficult time. 12 years prior to this, an empire called Babylon, the Babylonians, swept across the Fertile Crescent, down the Mediterranean coast, and they subjugated Jerusalem. Now, when this happened, the Babylonian king, Nebuchadnezzar, he didn't destroy the city of Jerusalem. Instead, he kidnapped the children of the nobility and brought them back to Babylon so he could keep their parents back in Jerusalem in line and under his control. He also demanded that the Jews pay this brutal tax, a tribute. And they did for a long time, knowing that there would be further humiliation if they disobeyed. The Jews cooperated. But about 8 years later, in 597 BC, popular opinion in the city of Jerusalem tipped, and they decided basically to give Nebuchadnezzar the middle finger. And they just totally rebelled, totally just rejected everything he was asking them to do. You can read Nebuchadnezzar's response to their rebellion in 2 Kings 24:14. It says that he, Nebuchadnezzar, carried into exile all Jerusalem, all the officers and fighting men and the craftsmen and the artisans, a total of 10,000 people. Okay, so now the parents whose children were kidnapped are themselves carted off to Babylon. And what's significant for us is that Ezekiel was one of those exiles. Okay, this is the world that Ezekiel is living in. He has been ripped away from everything that he knows. That's why when you read verse 1, he says, "It came about in the 30th year of the fifth day of the fourth month, while I was by the river Kabar, among the exiles," he says, "the heavens were opened and I saw visions of God." Among the exiles. That's where he's at. He is a captive in exile, and his whole thing that he's called to do is to serve other captives in exile. And it's so hard to, I just don't think you can overstate the disruption and the pain that Ezekiel and his brothers and sisters were experiencing. And so here's the first thing that we can learn about God's call. Seems counterintuitive, maybe a little bit unfair, but it is often true, even in our lives. When God calls us to do something, he often calls us during a time of great adversity. Just to help you appreciate the kind of adversity and pain that Ezekiel was in. I mean, he had trained, we know, I think it's from verse 3, he had trained most of his life to be a priest. And then at age 30, right as he was about to assume that role, he was taken captive. It'd be like training to be a doctor your whole life and then never getting to practice medicine. It was a crushing blow. That dream of being a priest was over. He and his people, they were ripped out of their homes. And I think it's hard to relate to this being in such a stable country. But can you imagine after like spending all of COVID improving your house? Right? Then just getting pulled away so you could never be there again, never enjoy the effort you put into your back patio or whatever it was you worked on. Absolutely turned their world upside down, carted off to a strange place with a weird language, a totally different diet, a belief system that stood against just about everything they believed, hundreds of miles from home. We know that the exiles would gather along a river, wherever they were at. He mentions here they would gather on the river Kabar. This is a place where the Jewish exiles would go to grieve the loss of their homeland. You can read about this in Psalm 137. "By the rivers of Babylon, we sat and wept when we remembered Zion," that's their capital city, There on the poplars we hung our harps, for there our captors asked us for songs. Our tormentors demanded songs of joy. They said, sing us one of the songs of Zion. How can we sing the songs of the Lord? The Jews would say, while we're in a foreign land. What do you mean sing? This is such a terrible place to be. If I forget you, O Jerusalem, may my right hand forget its skill. May my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth. If I don't remember you, if I don't consider Jerusalem my highest joy. That is some pain. That is a lot of pain. And into the midst of that pain and disruption, God says, yeah, Ezekiel, I'm calling you to do something difficult. This is the way it is. Adversity often puts us in new places with new people. And God sees us there and doesn't let us just hang up our cleats and walk off the field. It feels like who out there would dare ask me to do anything in the middle of my mess? And God's like, I would. I would do that. You know, you guys know my wife's got a bad case of cancer that we're still slogging through. And a while back, I went to a conference and attended a workshop on how to be a caregiver for a spouse with cancer, a partner with cancer. And I'll just be honest, I didn't want to be there. I didn't want to be with those people. You know, just sitting there going, I really wish my life hadn't brought me to this place. I know it's ugly. There you go. That's who I am. And so we're having this workshop, and they're laying out all these resources and ways that the James can help, which was great. But I look across the room, and there's a guy there, and he is obviously struggling a lot. He didn't say much the whole time. I just looked over, and I could tell he was really hurting. But the workshop ended, and it was lunchtime, and I didn't want to be there, and I was glad to leave, so I got up and left. I'm about 20 feet down the hall toward the lunchroom, and I get this call, this gentle nudge. Well, what about going back and checking in on that guy? What about just maybe trying to draw him out and try to be support? And I'm like, you know how you'll hear these calls and then the debate for another 10 or 20 feet. You're like, why me? Why now? I mean, cut me some slack. I mean, how is this going to go? Just a stranger? You know, you come up with 10 different reasons why it's a bad idea. And God just kind of presses in on your neck like, how about talking to the guy? So I got 40 feet down the hall. Spun around, trudged back, and I go into this conference room, and it was completely empty, except for this one guy. Anyhow, so he's there, and I didn't know what to say. I had written my phone number on a piece of paper. I just said, look, I know they have all these services and workshops you can go to, and you know, that's cool, but if you ever want to just get a cup of coffee and talk about having a wife with cancer, there's my number. And I left. And he looked at me kind of like, what? So I left, and that was all I thought about it until after lunch as I'm headed to the car. And holy crap, a couple texts. Boom, boom, from this guy. Yes, I do want to talk. Yes, I would like to get together. Yes, when can we meet? Apparently that was an opportunity, right, that God saw. God sees this. So yeah. It sucks to get a call from God. It feels misplaced in a difficult time. But man, when we respond, there are tremendous opportunities. So yeah, this is a thing. When God calls us, it'll be during a time of adversity. Now, here's another, just pressing on. It says, as I looked, behold. So he's having this vision of the Lord at the end of verse 1 is what it said. He looks in this vision and behold a storm wind coming from the north. And what unfolds in the next chunk of this chapter is one of the most stunning visions of the awesomeness of God in the entire Bible. And it just makes you ask, why? Why here? Why now? We know this. And you'll see this all through the Bible. God's call is often accompanied by a great display of his glory and power. Think about Moses seeing the burning bush, right? Then being called to rescue God's people. Or think about God calling the whole nation of Israel and then them seeing the Red Sea parted. What a display of power. And we see this with Ezekiel as well. As God's calling Ezekiel to this difficult task to get him ready, he pulls the curtain back and gives Ezekiel a vision of his glory. So let's just try to make sense out of it. As I looked, the storm wind was coming from the north, a great cloud, with fire flashing forth continually and a bright light around it. And in its midst, something like glowing metal in the midst of the fire. Maybe it looked like this, you know, like a thunderhead. And the thing with this storm is if you read, especially during this period of Israel's history, the concept of a storm, this specific word, is frequently associated with judgment. So there's this ominous sense that God's about to move. To move in judgment against his people. So he sees the storm wind, and then within that storm, there were figures resembling four living beings, and this was their appearance. So there's four of them. They had human form, arms and legs, that kind of thing. Each had four faces and four wings. Their legs were straight. Their feet were like a calf's hoof. And they gleamed like burnished bronze. Under their wings, on their four sides, were human hands. I know that looks like a little kid drew that. But honestly, that's one of the best pictures I could come up with online. A four-headed being with wings, kind of a bronze, polished bronze look, straight legs. As for the faces and wings, so now he's focusing on the faces. Their wings touched one another, and their faces didn't turn when they moved. Each went straight forward. As for the form of their faces, each had the face of a man. All four of these creatures had also the face of a lion on the right, a bull on the left, and all four of these creatures had the face of an eagle. Creepy, right? Something like that is what he's seeing. There's four creatures that look like this. He says, in the midst of the living beings, there was something that looked like burning coals of fire, like torches darting back and forth among the living beings. The fire was bright, lightning was flashing from the fire, and the living beings ran to and fro like bolts of lightning. Like, you know, in a July day, or not day, at night in July, you look across a field, and you see points of light, fireflies swarming. You know, especially just like along a hedgerow. It was like that, just intense light swimming among these creatures. Now, as I looked at the living beings, behold, there was a wheel on the earth beside the living beings. One wheel for each of the four of them. So each of these bizarre-looking beings has a special wheel. And it says, the appearance of the wheels and their workmanship was like sparkling beryl, which is like... Emerald is a type of beryl. It's a translucent gemstone. All four of them had the same form, their appearance and workmanship being as one wheel were within another. And whenever they moved in any of their four directions without turning as they moved. Okay, so these wheels, not one within the other like the rings on a target. Not like that. Probably at right angles like this. Because these wheels are able to go in any direction without turning. So something like that. Whenever the living beings moved, the wheels moved with them. Whenever the living beings rose from the earth, the wheels rose also. Over the heads of the living beings, there was something like an expanse, like the awesome gleam of crystal spread out over their heads. Under the expanse, their wings were stretched out straight. Like this, one toward the other. Each one also had two wings covering its body. On the one side and the other. Now, I think maybe for the first time, we can try to visualize this whole scene. And actually, I was able to locate an image that I think does a fantastic job capturing this. You've got those four living beings that are kind of bronze, polished bronze. Next to them are these wheels that follow them wherever they go, right? That move with those beings. And then above their heads, above their outstretched wings, is this expanse like the awesome gleam of crystal spread out over their head, that rectangular silvery expanse. And then we read above that expanse, over their heads was something resembling a throne, like lapis lazuli in appearance. Okay. Lapis lazuli is this really cool metamorphic rock that is radiantly blue. And so he's saying that this throne was radiantly blue, just strikingly like it's depicted here. And it says, and on that which resembled a throne, high up was a figure with the appearance of a man. And so if you zoom in and take a closer look, yeah, there's this human figure. Well, I would argue that's Jesus Christ, God himself, before he was on earth, on his throne, God on his throne. And he says, I noticed from the appearance of his loins upward something like glowing metal that looked like fire. And from the appearance of his loins downward, I saw something like fire. So just all fire. And there was radiance around him as the appearance of the rainbow in the clouds on a rainy day. So was the appearance of the surrounding radiance. Okay, so one last little detail he throws in is this rainbow, which if you remember, is God's bow. God's sign of the mercy he extends to us. It was connected to his promise back in Genesis 9 to never flood the earth, to never judge the earth again. And so there you go. Whoa. That's Ezekiel's exposure as he's called by God to the power and glory of God, which makes you go, what does it all mean? One of the most bizarre passages in the whole Bible. And I just don't think it's really difficult to figure this out. This is clearly an ancient account of an alien visitation. I mean, that's what we have. You've got these aliens, right? And it's not really wings, it's jetpacks. And, you know, if you doubt me, you can read a book by a NASA engineer called The Spaceships of Ezekiel. So, case closed. We can move on from this part of the book. Now, I think the easier way to figure out what this is maybe to read the next couple sentences in verse 28. Let's try that. Such was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. And when I saw it, I fell flat on my face and heard a voice speaking. Ezekiel falls flat on his face a lot in this book. I'm just preparing you in advance. This is going to happen quite a bit. Now, what did he see? What is the significance of this vision? It is the glory of the Lord. It is his awesomeness in his radiant power. It is the God who comes on a storm ready to judge and who yet is surrounded, who is full of mercy. That's what this is. That's what Ezekiel is supposed to get from this. And that is exactly what a man in pain, called to do a difficult thing, needs to see for him to do what God's called him to do. He needs to see that God is on his throne. That, yeah, Jerusalem is a mess. Yes, his people are in captivity. But this God is still a God of glory and power. That's what God is reminding Ezekiel of as he calls him. Now, I realize, and I'm sure somebody here has got to be thinking this, cool for Ezekiel. You know, that's great. But I haven't experienced that. Maybe you're sitting and you're aware. Yeah, like I was walking down the hall. Maybe there's something God's really been calling on you to do. But the temptation to just be like, ah, bad time, I don't have the resources. Maybe, Lord, if you could show me what you showed Ezekiel, I might find the inspiration to do it. But I'm sitting here, I just don't know. I just don't have the oomph to do much. Now, what would you say to somebody like that? I know what I would say. Well, I'd say two things. I'd say, I totally get it. I know what it's like. We all know what it's like when you're just so, it feels like you've been punched in the stomach. And the idea of doing anything seems impossible. I get it. But I also would say, every single one of us in this room right now has seen something just as glorious and powerful as Ezekiel saw. This is how the author of Hebrews puts it. He says, what we do see is Jesus, who for a little while was given a position a little lower than the angels, and because he suffered death for us, he's now crowned with glory and honor. Yes, by God's grace, Jesus tasted death for everyone. Tasted death. What's he talking about? He's talking about at the end of Jesus' life, he was nailed to a cross by the Romans, and that when he died, it wasn't just physical death by crucifixion. He took on his back all of the judgment for everything every human has ever done wrong, and he bore that judgment on himself on that cross when he died. And he also, by his mercy, extends the benefit of what he did on the cross, the undeserved gift of forgiveness to anyone who asks him for it. The storm of judgment and the bow of mercy, these two aspects of God's glory demonstrated on this event like no other. And what kind of God? What kind of God? What kind of God would offer his Son in death so that we can have life? A glorious God. That's the kind of God that we have. And so here we are on this side of this event. Who here could say, I'm going to need to see the glory of God before I can take action? I don't think any of us can say that when we're in the shadow of this event. And so, yeah, that's such a crucial point here. It's not that you need or that I need an experience like Ezekiel had. What we all need is to benefit in a bigger way from what Jesus has already done. That's a demonstration of God's awesomeness accessible to us all the time. And anytime we're like wrestling in the middle of what God's called us to do, looking for inspiration, we can go back to this, just like Ezekiel had his powerful vision. This is Milton Vincent, author of this book. And I put this book up there because it's written for Christians. And it's written to help you get more mileage out of the cross, out of the gospel, out of this offer of salvation for free based on Jesus taking on our judgment. And he just says, the gospel is one of the permanent circumstances in which I live and move. The gospel is not just one piece of good news that fits into my life somewhere among all the bad. He says, the gospel, you know, the cross, what Jesus did for us there, it makes genuinely good news out of every other aspect of my life, including my severest trials. There's no way we're going to relate properly to God's call when it comes unless our thoughts are filled with what God did for us through Christ. And so this is another thing. Yes, God's call has been attended with great power. He calls us often in adversity, and it is accompanied by a display of his glory and power that we've all seen. Now, one last thing on God's call. It's difficult. It is going to be. It always, almost always is difficult in a sense. The task that God calls us to do is beyond us in so many cases. Here, just soak this in. God said to me, Ezekiel says, Son of Man. Now, real quick, Son of Man was God's nickname for Ezekiel. You see this all the way through this book. Son of Man, Son of Man, Son of Man. That's, you know, God likes to give people nicknames, and that's Ezekiel's nickname. He said to me, Son of Man, stand on your feet. Remember, he had fallen flat on his face. So God's like, get up, that I may speak with you. And as God spoke to me, the Spirit entered me and set me on my feet, and I heard him speaking to me. And so here we finally get the specifics on this difficult call that came to Ezekiel. He said to me, Son of Man, I'm sending you to the sons of Israel, to a rebellious people who've rebelled against me. They and their fathers have transgressed against me to this very day. I'm sending you to them who are stubborn and obstinate children, and you shall say to them, Thus says the Lord God. That sounds rough. Not only are they obstinate and rebellious, but they have a long history of rebelling against God. And I want you to give them a message they don't want to hear, and we'll see how that goes. But think about it. A lot of the things God calls people to do, like the way God called Isaiah, similar difficulty. God calling Daniel to step up and face down the most powerful monarch in history. Think about all that. God calling his son Jesus to go all the way to the cross for us. God calling Paul to span the globe, planting churches. Nothing God calls us to is something we could manage on our own. All this is above our pay grade. And so one bad way when you're hearing God, your mission, if you care to accept it, one bad way to respond would be to say, I've got this. That's cool. All right, go talk to these exiles. I'll get that done. I remember years ago when my kids were really little, my wife was gone, and my youngest daughter came to me and asked me to put her hair in a ponytail. I'm like, I've got this. I totally have. I can do this. I've seen Edith do it a million times. I'll do it. So I'm like gathering her hair together and using a hairband. Make the ponytail, and then I pull back and look, and it's like coming out at 30 degrees off the back of her head. She's like, that's not right. So I regather her hair again, and I'm like, I'm trying to get it, but this time, like, you know, parts of her bangs are falling out. Then I try one more time, and she's like, that's not how mommy does it. You know, she's in pain because I'm trying to pull as hard as I can to get everything in a bunch. The thing is, I couldn't do it. I did not have it. Got it. Didn't got it. Yeah, above my ability. Silly, but actually true in that case. And so much of what we're being asked to do by God, called to do, is like that. For Ezekiel to go into a room full of dispossessed exiles with a history of cynicism, rebellion, and lack of faithfulness to God, and to change their hearts, if their hearts were to change, would it be because Ezekiel was that good? You think about us, like me getting up and teaching, and maybe somebody's heart is affected to follow God, or us trying to raise our kids to follow God. You think about all the things that God calls us to do. Impossible without his help. That is true. It's God that brings these miraculous heart changes in the people that he calls us to serve. And it would really be a mistake to forget that. So crucial. You know, did you notice in verse 2? Even for Ezekiel to just get off the ground and hear this message, it says the Spirit had to come to him and set him on his feet. The Spirit's got to come to you too. We as Christians, we have to remember he's with us, and we have to factor that in. And as we march out to carry out God's call, it's only the fact that the living God through his Spirit is with us that it's even possible. Another bad way to respond would be no thanks. Okay, some of us are the I've got this types. Others are more inclined to be this way. We get that it's difficult. We recognize the challenges. We can project into the future and we see only failure and destruction and decide I won't be doing that. Ezekiel was more this way, and look at what God tells him here. As for these exiles, whether they listen or not, for they're a rebellious house, they'll know that a prophet has been among them. And you, son of man, don't fear them or fear their words, though thistles and thorns are with you, and you sit on scorpions. Neither fear their words or be dismayed at their presence, for they are a rebellious house, but you will speak my words. He's kind of like, you're going to say yes to this call, whether they listen or not, for they're rebellious. So to somebody who's tempted to say no to God's call, what's his advice? One is, it's not your job to make anyone listen. You can't do that. That will never be your job. Your job is not to move the ball up the field. God does that. Your job is just to speak up. Just speak up. And not with some creative, witty insight, but what is he emphatic about? I want you to speak my words, my message. I remember another episode with a family member that I really care about, and this person was absolutely persuaded that the only way they'd be right with God was through good works, which the Bible completely rejects. The only way to be right with God is to receive the mercy that Christ bought for us on the cross. It's only as a gift that we can be right with God. But you know how it is when you're talking to someone and it's high stakes, you care about them. My tendency is to go, well, I've got me and my persuasiveness, and I've got them and some of the things they're hung up on. And that's kind of the problem space. This is what we're working. And according to this, that's not the case. According to this, in situations, and thankfully in this particular example, I had the presence of mind to go, wait a minute, I'm not alone here. God's Spirit's with me. Wait a minute, I don't have to come up with just the right thing to say. I have his message. And I just shot up a quick mental prayer. I showed this person a verse, that 1 Thessalonians 5 verse. It talks about our character transformation until we're with God. And it says at the very end, faithful is he who calls you. God will bring it to pass. And when I shared that verse, and this doesn't happen every time. It often doesn't happen, just like it often doesn't touch the hearts of the exiles. In this particular case, you could just see understanding. Like, oh, you could see heart change. And that was not anything persuasive or skillful. That was the presence of the Spirit, and that was the power of the message. And this is so, yeah, it's difficult, but we have to factor in. When we're called to go, we have his Spirit, and it's not our words, it's his words. And we're going to talk about those two things quite a bit as we keep going through this book. So, a couple questions to leave you with. Are you aware that God is calling you? Many of you are. You could probably say in a sentence what you feel like God's been nudging you to do. Maybe it's to finally surrender and trust him for forgiveness. Or maybe it's to reconcile with somebody in this room that you've been in a feud with for 2 years. I don't know what it is, but don't say no. Can you respond to his call in the midst of your pain? It's so tempting to just, I get a pass because this is a mess. Are you able to go, no, actually, God will speak to me in this mess, and when he does, it could be one of the most fruitful calls I ever respond to. Are you taking in his awesomeness on a regular basis? You know, just figuring out a way to slow down, maybe by reading the Gospels again, or reading that Gospel primer book, or watching Les Miserables. What a great movie that illustrates the gospel. And just trying to climb back into what it meant, that awesome display of power and glory on the cross. And what about this? Are you walking around like you've got to do the heavy lifting, or as you do respond to God's call, is there this awareness? The Spirit is with me, and I have the most potent message in the world to share. Amen.
Yeah. Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.